Hi there, you've made another good choice of RN podcasts. Why not also come over to the Religion and Ethics Report? We discuss the intersection of religion and politics, international affairs, war and peace. Find us at the RN website.
RN, your world unfolding.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. I'm Paul Barclay. Should the wealthy pay more tax? It's one of those perennial questions, isn't it? One at the heart of the debate over the proposed resource super profit tax. Is the hallmark of a civilised society that it ensures those less well off will not be left behind and that basic services like health and education are provided? If so, what happens when budgets can no longer meet expectations or demand? Where should the extra money come from? Should it come from higher taxes on the wealthy? Or do the well-off already make a substantial enough contribution to government revenue? And if you tax too much, will productivity and incentive drop off, leaving society and the overall economy worse off? Arguing that the wealthy should make a greater contribution, we have Leader of the Australian Greens, Senator Christine Milne. Richard Dennis, Executive Director of the think tank, the Australia Institute, and Jeff Cousins, former business and advertising executive, who's now an activist of sorts, fronting a number of high-profile environmental causes. On the opposing team, we have Greg Evans, Chief Economist at the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, Professor Judith Sloan, Contributing Economics Editor at The Australian, and former leader of the Liberal Party and now Company Director and Commentator, Dr. John Hewson. Time is short, so let's head to the Recital Hall in Angel Place, Sydney, for highlights of Should the Wealthy Pay More Tax? An Intelligence Squared debate. Opening the case for the affirmative, Dr. Richard Dennis of The Australia Institute.
I want to start with some good news. There's so much gloom in Australia, despite our apparent and our measured prosperity. I've just got back from overseas, where in Europe at the moment there are 20 million people unemployed. There are nearly as many unemployed people in Europe as there are people in Australia. But in Australia we've found that despite the fact that we have 5% unemployment, despite the fact that we have some of the lowest levels of public debt in the world, and despite the fact that, yes, we have one of the lowest levels of tax in the developed world, despite the fact that our GDP ranks us as amongst the wealthiest people the world has ever known, we hear a lot about the troubles that we have. Low unemployment, low debt, low taxes, and high disposable incomes. I'm sure we'll hear a lot tonight from my opponents about the burden of tax. They always talk about the burden, it's as if it's this giant backpack of tax that we just carry around with us wherever we go, the burden of tax. Well, yes, there's no doubt that paying tax is an expense. Just like repaying your car or paying off your holiday home, tax is a cost. In fact, it's often described as the price we pay for living in a civilised society. So let's start with some more good news. In the 20 years since I finished university, in the 20 years since then, GDP in Australia has doubled. GDP is twice as big today as it was in 1993. In fact, it's four times as big as when I was born about 43 years ago. Our GDP has grown 400%, fourfold. As a nation, we are four times as rich as when I was born. And being the clever country, being a knowledge nation, being an informed group of intelligent people in a democracy, we've spent that prosperity wisely. And we talk too much about our failures and not enough about our successes. So let's give ourselves a pat on the back, because here we stand in 2013, having nearly solved the shortage of mobile phones among 16-year-olds. Well done. And yes, there is still a shortage of holiday homes amongst the holiday homeless. And we are working as fast as we can with the four times bigger economy that we had when I was born to solve these pressing problems. Sorry, Indigenous people in remote areas. Sorry, parents who care for children 24 hours a day. Sorry for single mums. Sorry for the unemployed. We'd love to help. I mean, really love it. It's a priority. It's just there's no money. Maybe next time GDP doubles, we might find the money. Or maybe we might have to wait till it grows fourfold again. But surely here today in 2013, we couldn't possibly afford to solve those priorities because we don't have any money. Because before we can give more to those who have the least, you'll hear tonight, we have to cut taxes for those with the most. What you'll hear tonight is that the most important thing that we can do in Australia is cut the amount of tax that the highest income Australians contribute to our common good. What you'll hear tonight is that we need to do this in order to give incentive to those with the most, in order to be competitive with our Asian neighbours, or possibly simply to reward the hard work that it takes to be rich. And there's no doubt there is some merit in some of the arguments that you'll hear put by my rivals tonight. What you'll hear tonight is the upside. Vote for them at the end of the day, vote for a party that represents what you'll hear tonight, and you can all be free from the burden of tax. Well, that's fine, but there's no free lunch. If we as a society pay less tax, then we as a society will spend less on health and education. We will spend less on helping people with disabilities. We will spend less on propping up the incomes of people who work 40 hours a week for $32,000 a year, full time, because that's the minimum wage. We often hear that it takes $50,000 a year, tax-free, to retire with dignity. Well, if it takes $50,000 a year to retire with dignity, what do we say to people bringing up children on $32,000 a year and paying tax on it? So, of course we can cut taxes for you, for me, for everyone, for the wealthy. But there will be a downside, I suspect my opponents won't emphasise. And that is if we pay less money in tax, our governments will spend less money, again, on the services that we need or support for those who have the least. You'll probably hear a lot about incentive. We need to cut taxes to give people an incentive to work hard, like washing somebody else's house or cleaning toilets for $32,000 a year doesn't give people an incentive to find a better job. You'll hear that if we cut taxes, we can give people an incentive to work harder. This incentive argument's quite common amongst my economic colleagues. Lower the taxes, increase the post-tax take-home pay, we'll all want to work harder. Well, are my opponents here really suggesting that executives earning $10 million a year are currently sitting there thinking, well, I'm not going to put in a big day's work. I need a low tax rate to give me some incentive to work hard. Are my opponents here really suggesting that if we cut taxes, we could all work longer hours? Oh, fantastic. We can spend less time with our friends and family. GDP has doubled in the last 20 years. You'll hear tonight that low taxes might help GDP grow a little bit faster. There's no good evidence from overseas that it will, but there's no reason to think that we should want to live in a country where those with the most contribute even less and those with the least should expect even less. Thank you.
Richard Dennis. To open the case for the negative that the wealthy shouldn't pay more tax, here's Chief Economist at the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, Greg Evans.
Look, it's not surprising that a simple notion that appeals to our sense of fair go receives popular support. None more so than this simple idea that the wealthy or rich people should pay more tax. I think the message was also helped along by the promoters of this debate using the pictures of the same rich people, presumably lounging around on super yachts. Added to that, we know that the government's endemic budget problems and the need to fund important social programs. So the answer is fairly simple. Let those who are rich dig deeper and help us all out. Why hadn't finance ministers in struggling economies across the globe thought of this earlier? The trouble is the so-called wealthy, at least in Australia, already pay a lot of tax. So what are the facts on who pays the tax? We need to be reminded we have a highly progressive tax system. The more you earn, the tax you pay as a proportion of total income becomes higher, and much higher than for lower income earners. The whole topic exploits the ignorance of how the tax system works. In fact, a 2004 survey of taxpayer attitudes found that the majority of those surveyed did not understand the concept of progressive taxation. Our opponents know the concept, but they don't want to inform the debate because it erodes the fallacy of their dodgy arguments. I won't use too many numbers, and Professor Sloan is a better expose of this, but this simple fact, the top 20% of households by income already pay 61% of total income taxes, while the lowest 40% account for only 4% of total income taxes. That is, the top 20 income households pay 61% of total tax, the lowest only 4%. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to rain on the parade and shatter the conventional wisdom, but wealthier people already pay much more tax. Okay, so let's take leave of our senses and suppose we apply higher taxes on wealthy people. What are the economic implications of hitting up wealthier people? What is the impact on individual behaviour and businesses? Is there an economic or financial dividend for government? Unfortunately for the high tax proponents, the news is mostly bad. Let me quote Winston Churchill, when 110 years ago he elegantly observed, "For a nation to try to tax itself into prosperity is like a man standing in a bucket trying to lift himself up by the handle." Perhaps our debating opponents could demonstrate this for the audience. Or more recently, the 2004 Economics Nobel Laureate Edward C. Prescott noted, "Lower taxes are good for all taxpayers. We're barking up the wrong tree if we think taxing the rich will solve our problems. The whole economy suffers under such a scenario, not just a few individuals who are taxed at a higher rate." Yes, lower taxes do help the economy, and higher taxes do harm the economy. Now, you look like a sophisticated audience, so I hardly need to go through this, but individuals and business respond to the incentive message of lower taxes. I'm sorry, Richard, they do. Prudent governments foster this phenomenon as it encourages economic activity, GDP grows, and so do revenues. Consequently, far from increasing taxes to be paid by the so-called wealthy, we should aspire to lower the top marginal rate and the next highest rate, and this needs to be an important economic reform objective. I'm not sure who the wealthy are because that is a subjective judgment, but let's assume, as the federal government seems to, that they occupy at least the top two tax brackets. So what are these positive incentive effects playing out with individual and business? Firstly, lower taxes bolster workforce participation. High taxation rates applied to personal income makes people less willing to work. And this is especially the case for secondary income earners who tend to be women. Therefore, lowering tax rates is positive in augmenting the supply of labour. And this certainly is a good economic and social achievement. Lower taxes also promote entrepreneurship. Personal income tax is not just a tax on wages and salaries. Personal income also includes individual income from unincorporated business, many of which are small businesses. And they are particularly responsive to the level of tax in their willingness to undertake entrepreneurial activity. Sinclair Davidson of the Centre for Independent Studies has compiled work that shows that tax rates have an important effect on entrepreneurial activity and survival. Importantly, a lower tax rate increases after-tax income, which can be reinvested in the business, leading to higher and faster growth. Additional income can also be used to employ extra workers. One study showed that higher tax rates can have the effect of jeopardising such opportunities, or it may lead to the employment at lower income levels. In other words, your wage is lower because the boss has a higher tax liability. Now, we don't just make this up. I represent the Chamber of Commerce. We have more small business members than any other organisation in Australia. We routinely survey small business, and we ask them, well, why aren't you investing? And the number one response is business taxes and charges. Let me turn to another consequence of high taxes, the Australian diaspora. It's estimated there are more than 1 million Australians living overseas. There are apparently a variety of reasons for living outside this country, yet relatively high personal tax are regarded as a major factor. A 2004 report from the Lowy Institute dissected the diaspora and showed that more than half live under lower tax burden countries than they would have in Australia. We can only conclude a less onerous taxation regime may be helpful in attracting back these skilled workers to Australia. If you doubt this, just consider our top marginal rate of 46.5%, and Hong Kong 15, Singapore 20, and New Zealand, even New Zealand 33. Maintaining our competitiveness has to be an important constraint when considering tax rates. Contrary to the views of our high tax friends here tonight, we don't have an unfettered discretion to raise taxes. Otherwise, the rest of the world will make its own judgments and decide where to invest. Again, our company tax is 30%, while Hong Kong is 16.5%, Singapore 17%, New Zealand 28%. We're even higher than the EU average of 23%. In a lopsided treatment of the issue, we seem to accept the integrity of the argument to lower company tax rate, as Henry did in the Henry Review, and all the intended economic benefits it may bring. However, because so-called wealthy individuals benefit from lowering the top marginal rate, it is far less palatable for policymakers, yet no less economically beneficial. My friends, in summary, to argue the case in support of higher taxes for the wealthy is driven by a mixture of ignorance and divisiveness. To recap, the wealthy pay the most tax. Higher taxes will reduce work incentives and participation. Small business and start-up activity, these are not rich people, will be adversely affected, as will employment opportunities across the income scale. More Australians will move overseas as tax exiles, and our homegrown businesses will become less competitive as other countries widen the gap. Finally, revenue and economic growth will be lower than it otherwise could be if we increase taxes. The question of wealthy people paying more tax may have an appealing and naive attractiveness, but it provides a false hope and is economically damaging. Thank you.
Greg Evans. Should the wealthy pay more tax? Our next speaker for the affirmative in this IQ Squared debate is Senator Christine Milne, leader of the Australian Greens.
Well, thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and it's particularly pertinent that I do that because Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are severely disadvantaged. Everybody knows that. And when you raise this issue in Parliament especially, people say, well, yes, that's true, but we actually can't afford to do more. Well, I'd say, Mr Evans, we can afford to do more, and it's not a case, yes, of lifting ourselves up in a bucket. It's actually about providing ourselves with a platform so that we can join together and lift one another up. And that is why the wealthy should pay more tax in Australia. I want to go on to say that historically we've seen ourselves as a country of the fair go. We don't want to be the class system that was in the UK. We don't want to be the gated communities that are in the US. But increasingly, that is not the case in this country. We are not the country of the fair go anymore. And that goes to the heart of this debate. What sort of country do we want to live in? What sort of society do we want to be part of? And that goes to the issue of equality of opportunity. And the fact is, the gap between the rich and the poor in Australia is expanding. And as it expands, it brings with it a lot of social problems. And we will all pay for those social problems into the future. The happiest, the most secure, the most prosperous countries are in the world are those where they are reducing the gap between the rich and the poor, not allowing it to expand. Now, I have to tell you from my point of view, this debate tonight is not just a debate, it's actually a passion, and it's something that I stand up every day in the Parliament and argue. It is something that this nation has to face right now. And that is, we live in a society, not an economy. And I'm sick to death of people standing up saying, this is what the economy needs. No, it is not what the economy needs. It's what the community needs, the society needs, and the economics have to be the tools that deliver what we want. And if we want high-speed rail, if we want in Australia to have urban rail, if we want 100% renewables, if we want a first-class education system, if we want equal access to health, for example, if we want to rapidly get away from digging up, cutting down and shipping away to a much more sophisticated economy, then we have to pay for it. And that is the absolute point here. We have to raise the money. And so that's why the wealthy should pay more tax. Now, Mr. Evans said, and I agree with him, that it's a popular notion. Yes, it is. And he goes on to say, well, why haven't politicians thought of it earlier? Well, I'll tell you why they won't do it, because they don't have the political will to do it. That is what it takes. We know the community supports it. So let me give you an example. You go into the parliament and the old parties are terrified of raising taxes. They won't stand up to the wealthy corporates and to wealthy individuals. And why is that? Because they know that those wealthy individuals and those corporates will punish them, will take out the advertising that will do them in. And if you need an example of that, the super profits tax was the classic case. The mining industry paid $20 million in advertising and saved themselves $40 billion. Not a bad return on that advertising. Now, this goes to the heart of our democracy. Who is running the country? Who is actually delivering for the people and not for the most wealthy and the big corporates? And let me tell you, if we fix the mining tax, we could raise $21.8 billion in the period 2014 to 2017. And if we don't, who are the big losers? We've just heard that the rich or the wealthy can't pay, and then heard Mr. Evans talk about a whole lot of people who are not wealthy, like small businesses. No one is suggesting that they're the wealthy in this country, but I can tell you who are not wealthy and who are the poor and who are the biggest losers here, and they're people who are on Newstart. They're people who are single parents. There are universities. For goodness sake, why would we be taking $2.3 billion out of our universities right now and say to the rich, we don't expect you to pay more tax, but we are going to undermine the future of this country? Because let's face it, if you are going to nation build, we need to invest in education from early childhood right through schools into our universities, because it is in those universities that will drive the new industries, the new jobs, the whole new future for this country. And that is crazy, to say we are not going to tax the rich, we are not going to make them pay more taxes. Instead, we are going to undermine universities and, what's more, take it out of the pockets of students and convert their scholarships to debt. Well, that is a very bad idea, because it will act as a big disincentive, particularly to students from rural communities, from lower income families. Also, when we get to the free ride that's going on here, the wealthy are getting an incredibly free ride. And I want to give you the example of the coal industry. They are out there. They want to dump 22 million cubic litres of spoil from dredging in the Great Barrier Reef. They want to build these new ports there, dump it on the Great Barrier Reef. They're driving global warming. And then we have extreme weather events, which the climate scientists say, yes, are made more intense by climate change. And who has to pay? The community pays with a levy, a flood levy, $6 billion into Queensland. So we've got privatising the profit and socialising the costs. And so that's why we have to get on and say we need transformation in the economy. We need to make sure those who can pay do pay. And in terms of the community being prepared to pay, the community are much more generous. The community said, yes, we're prepared to pay a flood levy to help people who are disadvantaged by the floods. The community also said they're prepared to pay the National Disability Insurance levy, because they do think it's fair and appropriate that we have a scheme that helps people with disability. And so what we've got is a community saying to the political process, if this is justified, if this is fair, if this improves our community, we're prepared to pay for it. And yet you've got a political process, a political culture in the old parties in Australia that will not tax the wealthy. And that is where we are getting into really big problems. Let me go to the banks for a moment. The community came to the rescue of the four big banks, for goodness sake, in the global financial crisis. We stumped up and we said, as a community, we will guarantee the four big banks. We will do that. We will take all the risk as the community through the government. We will do that. And what have the four big banks done in return? Have they passed on the full interest rate cuts? Have they gotten rid of their ATM fees, which are unjustified? No, of course, they have not done that. So we think it is appropriate that they should actually, the four big banks who are getting cheaper wholesale funding because they've got the guarantee of the government, we think it's time that a levy was imposed on them. Not only would it be great for the community and bring forward education funding for Gonski, bring forward the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which we all want, bring forward investment in our health and education system and get rid of the university cuts, but it would increase competition in the marketplace, and it's unfair at the moment on the smaller banks and credit unions and the like. Now, what about the argument that if the big companies don't pay taxes, such as more taxes, then they will generate more jobs? No. 457 visas. They don't pay to skill up people in the workplace. They're trying to get people in overseas who have been educated overseas. Secondly, we saw in 2009 the mining industry shed 15.2% of their employees as they went into a downturn. So finally, I want to say to you that the wealthy in Australia should pay more tax. We need it for nation building. We need it for health and education. We need to reduce the inequality that we're experiencing and to have greater social harmony and happiness. We need it to look after the environment. We need it to raise the revenue, because those who have the wealth, individuals and corporations, have benefited from the wealth of the earth, from the atmosphere, from the labour of others and the generosity of other taxpayers, as well as the massive tax havens and loopholes that they have benefited from to the detriment of the broader community. We can't wait for the wealthy in Australia to pay more tax.
Senator Christine Milne, you're with Big Ideas on RN and online. Tonight we're in Sydney for an Intelligence Squared debate that the wealthy should pay more tax. To advance the counter-arguments, here's Professor Judith Sloan, contributing economics editor for The Australian.
If I ask the people here today to put up their hands if they regard themselves as being wealthy, I'm not going to. I'm sure there would be a very meagre show of hands. So when people think about the proposition that the wealthy should pay more tax, it is hardly surprising that, at first blush, there is near universal endorsement. Make the rich pay more. Not me, of course. But the rich, the wealthy, and we've heard that on show with great gusto from Christine. It's a case of tax the rich, feed the poor, and make those wealthy companies pay more too. Christine, I would like to point out they do, but I'll get back to that. Make the rich pay more tax. Now, if it only were that simple, but who are the wealthy, I hear you ask, and how much tax do they pay now? Have the wealthy been paying more or less tax over time? And what are the real consequences of getting the wealthy to pay more tax? Consider first the definition of wealthy. Strictly speaking, wealth and income are different concepts. Some wealthy people actually have low incomes. There are those who, you know, happen to end up in large houses in prestigious parts of Sydney. They're wealthy, but they may actually have quite low incomes. And not all those on high incomes are wealthy. It's easier for me to figure out who the high income earners are when it comes to salaried employees, the payee tax earners. But it's much harder for me to figure out who the high income earners when it comes to business owners. I think that was a point you conceded. Thank you very much, Christine, that we have to be very careful when we think about business owners, because a lot of business owners are actually not wealthy. We actually also don't have very good information on wealth, and because our taxation system by and large taxes income and not wealth, I've tried to kind of skew this debate to actually suggest that what the organisers really meant is that the high income earners should pay more tax. We have a capital gains tax. It doesn't raise an enormous amount of money, certainly not at the moment. And the single biggest source of Commonwealth taxation receipts is in fact personal income tax. So I think when we're kind of trying to narrow down the debate, think about that. So that makes up nearly half of all tax receipts, personal income tax. It's about, at the moment, $180 billion a year. The next biggest single source of revenue, tax revenue though, Christine, is company tax. And it makes up about 20% of all taxation receipts. So the notion that companies are not contributing to taxation revenue in this country is just untrue, and I'll get back to that a little later. So, in addressing the proposition that the wealthy or high-income earners should pay more tax, there is an implicit assumption that the wealthy are not paying enough tax now. But the reality is that it is only the wealthy who pay any tax now. It is hard to conceive of the wealthy in Australia paying any more tax because they are already paying all the tax. Don't believe me? Well, let me look at the figures from the Australian Tax Office. Okay, we've got a trouble. We're not all clear what we think about wealthy, but let me first of all take the top 25% of income earners. So the top 25% currently pay over two-thirds of the tax. Okay, 25%, top 25% pay two-thirds of the tax. Okay, I'm sure most people would agree with me that is a case of the wealthy paying the tax. And just in case you think, and I think, Christine, you might have been mistaken on this point, that the wealthy have been paying less tax over time, let me tell you that the reverse is the case. So back in the mid-1990s, for example, the top 25% of income earners paid just under 61% of the tax. They now pay 67.4%. So in 15 years, the increase in the income tax share of the wealthy, defined as the top 25%, has risen by nearly 7 percentage points. That is a lot. Now, maybe it might be easy for you to relate to this if I put some dollars around this. So take someone who's earning over $100,000 a year. Okay, that's about about 7% of income earners. They paid, so 7% paid 18.4% of the tax. So the point I'm trying to get at is think of them in the percentage terms and how much tax revenue they're contributing to. Let's go to the really top wealthy ones. The top 2% cut in at $170,000 a year. Okay, so 2%, they paid 10%. Of the total tax. And wait for this, the top 1%, it cuts out in at around $270,000 a year. 1% pays 17% of all income tax revenue. So on the Occupy Movement's definition of the wealthy, the top 1% of income earners paid nearly 20% of all income tax paid. And what happens at the bottom, the people we are trying to look after, and I totally agree with that, don't those from Struggle Street pay tax too? Take those ones up to the minimum wage that Richard mentioned. In fact, the bottom 25%, okay, the lowest income earners, paid only 3% of the tax. So the bottom 25% paid only 3% of the tax. Now, that is how it should be. Australia has a highly progressive income tax arrangement in which high-income earners pay the vast bulk of the tax and low-income earners pay virtually nothing. And if we take into account cash transfers, so money that the government gives to various citizens, we find that the bottom 60% of households, so not individuals, households, pay no net tax at all. It's actually not true, Christine, that the gap between the rich and the poor is getting wider. It's actually narrowing, if you really want to know. And it is only those households with incomes in excess, households' income in excess of $100,000 per year that make any net contribution to the tax take after cash transfers are taken into account. We are the country of the fair go. We have the most progressive distribution of benefits and tax in Australia, with the exception of Denmark. Well, let me just quickly go on to companies. Australia has, as Greg pointed out, a very high rate of corporate tax. Company taxes make up, as I mentioned, 20% of all tax revenues. But here's the kicker, Christine. The four big banks, okay, the four big banks that you want to tax even more, pay nearly 40% of all company tax revenue. They are profitable and make huge contributions to the tax coffers of the government. And by the way, the government never bailed out the big banks. And by the way, the banks pay a fee for that guarantee. And by the way, the banks would like to get rid of it. And finally, mining companies, do they pay their fair share? You bet they do. The top three mining companies account for 20% of all company tax revenue. So here's the deal. The wealthy should not pay more tax because the wealthy already pay all the tax. Indeed, the wealthy have been paying a higher proportion of tax revenue over time, and companies also make a major contribution to tax receipts. We should be proud of our highly redistributive system of income tax and transfers. And rather than contemplating higher taxes, what we should really be doing is debating the proper role of government and to accept that the government, like all of us, need to live within their means.
Professor Judith Sloan, and to conclude for the affirmative team in this IQ Squared debate and argue in favour of the motion that the wealthy should pay more tax, here's businessman and environmental activist Jeff Cousins.
I don't know whether there's anyone here, ladies and gentlemen, who's ever driven from San Francisco up Highway 1, up the Big Sur, up to Pebble Beach and Carmel. That's a wonderful drive. I did it some years ago. I rented a red Mustang convertible in San Francisco and put the Beach Boys on the radio there and drove up, the wind blowing through my thick curly locks, and just the most beautiful place you'd ever see. And some of the most expensive homes in the United States, in the world, are up there. They're a little bit hard to see because most of them are in those gated communities that Christine quickly mentioned. I was astonished to find that there are 8 million people in the United States who live in gated communities now. Amazing figure, isn't it? And, of course, they're very secure. That's why the wealthy people like to live there. They can have guards and big walls and so on. And, of course, in the United States, because you have the right to bear arms in the Constitution, the guards don't just have batons or things like that. They can have automatic assault rifles and so on. And so they're very secure, except, of course, the right to bear arms also applies to the people who would like to get in to steal the money from them. So they also have presumably automatic assault rifles. So maybe that cancels it out a bit. If you look around the world, again, I was astonished to find in Mexico nearly 60 million people live in these gated communities, the wealthy people, naturally. And in places like South Africa, those gated communities have even extended to have their own police forces, their own hospitals, their own fire services. So the wealthy people are able to, I suppose, almost never go out into the real world. It doesn't sound like a very happy thing to me, though, if you're a wealthy person and you've worked so hard and contributed so much to society, and then you've got to lock yourself away. That seems an unhappy thing for wealthy people to do, does it not? It's because of the inequality. It was President Obama who said in his latest State of the Union address that inequality was the greatest issue of our time. And I think he's right, and he's talking about that sort of thing. So it struck me that if we want the wealthy to pay more tax, and we do here, the attractive people, they want that we probably ought to see what it would be that would make wealthy people happy. And indeed, it's extraordinary when you look at that. There's quite a lot of evidence about that. There's a very famous man in the United States, Professor Shigehiro Oishi of the University of Virginia, who was responsible for coordinating a massive worldwide study, 54 nations around the world, looking for a correlation between happiness and the tax system. And you know what that study found? The Gallup company did it. Nearly 60,000 respondents in this. They found that the countries that were happiest had the highest tax rates. The highest tax rates. Now, isn't that remarkable? And you'd say, well, that would be true because, you know, there are more benefits coming to the people, but it wouldn't be true of the rich people. They'd be very unhappy. But there was just at the end of last year another enormous study carried out by a business, American Express, and the Harrison Group. Another extremely large study. And do you know what they found? They found that 67% of the top 1% of wealthy people, more than two-thirds of them, wanted to pay more tax. This nonsense that is coming out from our opponents here, that in fact wealthy people would feel put upon and so on. No, you've heard some famous wealthy people, including even Bill Gates in this very country only a few days ago. You've heard from people like Warren Buffett in the United States, perhaps the wealthiest man, but certainly one of them there, saying, I want to pay more tax. The concept that wealthy people would feel put upon and that they wouldn't work as hard, they'd stop working and they wouldn't contribute as much, is nonsense. There are two massive studies that show that. The true fact of the matter is this. The percentage of total wealth that is being put into the hands of a few people is growing and growing in all Western countries, including this one. And the statistics are absolutely frightening. In the United States, and this is a fact that's been checked by PolitiFact, verified, and so on, wealthiest 400 people in the United States have a total net wealth equal to the entire wealth of the bottom 50%. 400 people in the United States have it. I mean, can you believe that? In Australia, these figures are pretty hard to get, but there was a very good article in the Global Mail that worked out some figures from that were available and came to the point that the top 1% in Australia have a total net worth equal to the bottom 50%. Now, if the wealthy people, and the rate of growth of that thing in Australia is higher even than it is in the United States, if the wealthy people don't pay more tax, who is going to pay it, since more and more of the wealth is going into fewer and fewer hands? You know, it was very interesting when Mitt Romney was running for president in the United States, because you don't often see, you don't get an insight into how much tax wealthy people pay. But we got his tax return, and 14.6%, not the 40 or the 30, because wealthy people have all sorts of ways of not paying tax. Now, I've been called in the press a wealthy person, so I'm going to wear that tag tonight. And I thought I'd get a T-shirt made that said, I'm rich, tax me. But I didn't have time to do that. But I want all of you here to imagine that you are also rich like me, even if you're not, just for this one thing. And we could all shout out together, I'm wealthy, tax me. I'm wealthy, tax me. I'm wealthy, tax me. And all these people could hear that. So just give me one big shout on the count of three. I'm wealthy, tax me. Ladies and gentlemen, you've set me free, thank you, from the bottom of my bank account.
Jeff Cousins. And your final speaker tonight in this IQ Squared debate is John Hewson, a company director, commentator and former Liberal politician.
The wealthy should pay more tax. Look, I strongly oppose this as a simplistic, politically motivated, populist notion that we can solve all our budgetary problems and meet all our social welfare objectives by simply taxing wealthy people more. It cannot be done. The magnitude of the cash requirements to fund government today and the commitments that have been made cannot be met by simply taxing the wealthy. And my colleagues here have given you the hard data for what percentage of income earners pay how much of the tax, and the majority of it, is paid by the top income earners. And of course, you know, those 400 Americans, I mean, even if you tax them completely, you wouldn't meet the $1 trillion deficit in the US, the 100% of GDP in debt. You wouldn't be able to satisfy the welfare and spending commitments of the US government. I mean, it cannot be done. It is not a deliverable policy. These simplistic sort of populist political notions really, to my mind, have cost us what should otherwise have been a sensible debate about reform of the tax system in this country. There are many examples going back over the last 30 years of where sensible tax reform has been squandered because of some political undeliverable slogan which has been run, or some political act, or some political deal which has set aside genuine reform. You can go back to the Keating 1985 tax package, a broad-based reform of the tax system. It was undone by a secret motel deal room between Bob Hawke and Bill Kelty that neutered the essence of that tax reform proposal. I can talk about my own poorly sold experience in 1993, where I was undermined by a very successful campaign by the same Keating. He promised LAW tax cuts. He legislated them. The greatest lie of all time, because 6 months later he had to admit he could not deliver those tax cuts, even though they were legislated, without a GST. The effectiveness of the Howard tax package was similarly undermined by political deals. And, of course, the cleverness of the Howard package was he gave the revenue to the states, knowing full well that year in, year out, there would be a debate between the states as to the distribution of that tax revenue, making it very difficult, if not impossible, to actually reconsider that tax and severely constrained its use as a flexible fiscal instrument. The Henry tax review was constrained because it wasn't allowed to look at the GST as a political measure. Various tax summits that have been held with the business community have been constrained because they're not allowed to look at the GST and other dimensions of the tax system. They're political constraints that have been put on a sensible debate about tax reform in this country. The carbon price, and a very important initiative which some of us campaigned for strongly, was easily undone as a carbon tax. The mining tax, which was to distribute benefits to the broader Australian community, was easily neutered by a deal done simply to win an election. A host of examples in the last 30 years of political deals which have compromised our capacity to reform tax. Moreover, there's a simplistic notion in the electorate about tax reform. I mean, to most people, tax reform means simply lower tax, which sort of denies the demographic trends, the ageing of the population and other factors, which suggests that perhaps tax burdens will need to increase rather than decrease if we're to deal with those demographic factors, and if we're to meet the ever-expanding structural deficit in this country, if we're ever to satisfy the expenditure commitments that have been made that are very significant. I mean, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, Disability Care, is essentially unfunded. It's going to cost in excess of $30 billion a year when fully operational in the early 2020s. That's unfunded. Gonski is essentially unfunded. And a host of others, infrastructure programs that are committed almost on a daily basis, are essentially unfunded. And you're not going to get genuine tax reform in this country when you have situations where welfare benefits, which are given, soon become a right, which are very difficult to target and very, very, very difficult to reform. And, of course, if you look for international comparisons, there's always a race to the bottom. Who's got the lowest tax rate on anything is seen to be the winner. These are significant constraints in the expectations of the electorate about tax reform against the context, as I've said, of a number of successive political deals and constraints that have restricted genuine tax reform in this country. So I think that, you know, if I'm to summarise a position going forward, it's going to be very difficult to reform tax in this country. And to have a sensible debate about it, particularly when it's overridden by slogans that, you know, the wealthy should pay more tax. Neither the political parties today will contemplate raising personal tax or corporate tax or capital gains tax. And there are a lot of complexities in the relationship between the Commonwealth states and states when it comes to taxation. And I mentioned the magnitude of some of the expenditure commitments that have been made that remain unfunded at this time. So this focuses the debate away from broadening the tax base or increasing the burden of any part of that tax base to look at the areas where the tax system offers great concessions for particular activities or particular sectors. And the obvious ones are housing, superannuation, are the two major ones. So I think housing has probably got a $40+ billion concession, but I can't see either government wanting to go and tax the capital gains on a family home, or to introduce a tax on negative gearing or restructure negative gearing. Similarly, super taxes now, you know, there's about $32 billion worth of benefits that go into super. Governments have made a mess of this year in, year out, playing around with superannuation to the point where it's basically off the agenda, at least in the forthcoming election. Both parties have put it off the agenda for the next parliamentary term. So that only leaves one area in which you can actually reform tax, and that's to do something about indirect tax, dare I say, the GST. Now, I'm not going to sit up here tonight and take the opportunity to try and explain to you again the impact of the GST on a birthday cake. But I am going to say that that provides the mechanism by which we can genuinely restructure tax. Yet the GST is off the agenda by both parties going into the next parliamentary term. We aren't going to have a sensible debate about tax until we face the reality of the need to look at the broadening of that indirect tax base. Now, we've heard the numbers of the revenue that's raised by individual personal income tax, from corporate tax and so on. The GST today only raises $50 billion, and it covers only about 60 to 65% of total expenditure. If you broaden the base to everything to cover 100% of expenditure, and if you increase the rate to say, let's say, I'm not advocating, but let's say double, you can take that $50 billion a year to $140 billion a year. And that gives you the capacity to seriously restructure the tax system, the corporate tax system, the personal tax system, and the welfare system, a capacity that you don't have today and you won't get by pretending that you can simply increase the tax on the wealthy. I think my simple point is that we've had too much politics and too little realistic approach to the issue of tax. I think perhaps I'd have to conclude by saying I think the taxation reform is far too important to be left to politicians. So we've got to find a way in which we can deal with this beyond the political process, at least in the first instance. So I would have a tax commission. I would have a group that are independent of government, like we have a Reserve Bank that's independent of government, a future fund that is independent of government. I'd have a tax commission that completely reviews the expenditure commitments of government, the funding of those commitments, and makes recommendations probably through a COAG process as to how we should reform the tax system, should reform the welfare system in a sensible, objective manner. And until we have that sort of independent assessment of the process of the tax structure and the welfare structure in this country, we won't make any significant progress. And to imagine that we can simply say, let's just tax the rich more, it's an undeliverable, hypocritical, short-term populist objective. Thank you.
John Hewson, who together with Judith Sloan and Greg Evans tonight argued against the proposition that the wealthy should pay more tax. On the affirmative team, you heard from Jeff Cousins, Christine Milne and Richard Dennis. And now to who won. As you may know, at all Intelligence Squared events, the audience is polled with their views on the topic both before and after the debate. Before the debate, 21% were undecided, 18% were against, and 61% were for the motion that the wealthy should pay more tax. After the debate, the undecideds had dropped to 8%, 34% were against the motion and 58% were for it. The motion that the wealthy should pay more tax was carried. That's it for Big Ideas for tonight. Tomorrow night at 10 on Friday Late on RN, the best of Big Ideas, when we'll be looking at maths and science education in Australia. Enrolments are falling and demand is up. In international education performance assessments, Australia is dropping down the ranks. Are we facing a maths and science education crisis? That's the best of Big Ideas on RN at 10 tomorrow night. Or download this or any other Big Ideas program from our website, abc.net.au/radionational. Just scroll through the list of programs and click on Big Ideas. On behalf of the hard-working production team, Jim Usher, Peter McMurray, David LeMay, Ian Coombe and Karen Zivanovitz, I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now. We have fair trade coffee and fair trade bananas, so why not a fair trade mobile phone?
A Dutch company wants to change the way our products are made. They've developed the Fairphone, the world's first ethically made cell phone. We talked to the company's CEO, Bas van Abel, about the project and the philosophy behind it. That's Future Tense, and you can download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.